Okay, for all our benefits, just a little bit of a recap on where we've gone so far. We talked in the first session on John's Gospel about the distinctives of it as opposed to the other three Gospels, the Synoptics. And we have four P's, which you can remember. John was written for a different period, a different place, a different purpose. Right, you're not doing these anything in the right order. A different period. We said it was much later, didn't we, than the other three Gospels. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was written by a different person, John, one of the Jesus' closest disciples. And it was written from a different place, which was Ephesus, which is in Turkey. So we talked about that and the implications of that for it. We looked at some of the stuff that John leaves out. So no miracles, no parables in John's Gospel, for example. But we also said that he puts a lot of stuff in that you won't find in the other three Gospels. And often that is about with individuals. In the other Gospels, Jesus spends his time, or a lot of his time, with the crowds. In John, he's very much more to be found with individuals, Nicodemus, the woman at the well, what have you. Then last time, we looked at the prologue, first 18 verses, which we said set the scene for the whole thing. And then last time, we asked the question, what is John's gospel with a small g? What is his message? And we said that what he uses is a series of contrasting pairs, like light and darkness. Well done. Yeah. I'll give you the first one, see if you can get the second one. Sight or seeing and blindness. Yeah. Accepting or rejecting. Life.
Death.
And this world and eternity. And what did we say about those contrasts in particular? There's no middle ground. Look. No, hey. No middle ground. And Jesus is there to face people with a stark choice. Which of those two columns are you going to live for? Which of those are you going to be about? Okay, so we've got two more sessions left. Tonight, I want to look at what John says about Jesus in relation to the Jewish religion of the time, and then fortnight's time, talk about Jesus and God. Okay, so that's where we're going tonight. Now, I need to get one question out of the way right at the start as we look at this. And this is a typical essay question for theological students. Is John's gospel anti-Semitic? And the more we become politically correct as a nation, the more that becomes a real issue. And a lot of people really don't like John's gospel because he doesn't have anything to say about the Jews. And that's led some people to say it's an anti-Semitic gospel. It's not worthy of, you know, shouldn't be in the Bible. It's nasty and just slightly Nazi in its outlook. I think I want to say to that yes, John does have a bit of a down on the Jews. But he always uses the term as a religious term and not as a racial term. And we'll see tonight that the things that John says negative about Judaism are not about a race of people. They are about a religious system. And I think that we need to kind of just understand that first in case our sensitivities are raised about that. So John is not racist, but he does have some quite hard things to say about the religious systems and so on. Now, we've spent, this is now what, number four with John, and we're getting to know him a bit. We're getting to know the kind of way he works. So if John is going to make Jesus say some stuff which is critical of the Jewish religious system, how is he going to do that? What is John's methodology? In the Synoptics, in the other three Gospels, he tells parables about it, doesn't he? To make that point, he tells a story where someone is the villain, as it were, and that's
like
often
the Pharisee and the tax collector.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. That's their methodology, but we know that John doesn't do that. How do we think he might be going to get that point across? Any ideas?
Well,
he is going to do a stark contrast, but how is he going to portray that, do we think? Some of it is going to be with real people, yeah, certainly. What does John love? We had it particularly in the prologue, all sorts of... Yeah, playing about with words. That's an important theme in the prologue, certainly. Shall I tell you?
Yeah.
This isn't working. He's not going to come out and say it, well, he is occasionally, but he's going to do it through symbolism, because that's what he does. He doesn't just say there's a stark contrast. He says light, darkness, life, death, and all that kind of thing. And so we're going to see how, using symbolism, John gets Jesus' attitude over towards the Jewish religious system. So where do you think he's going to start?
Yeah.
In the beginning, meaning... Okay. What does John use to introduce the themes that are going to follow through? I'll give you a clue. The prologue. Those first 18 verses in chapter 1, we said... is where John's going to launch a lot of the themes that he's then going to unpack as they go through. Yeah? So where in the prologue can we find the first hint that Jesus and Judaism might not be the best of friends? And I'll give you a clue. If you're skim reading through the prologue to find the answer to that, start at the end, not the beginning.
Oh, thank you.
Or we could be here somewhere else.
Verse 17,
which says, okay, that's it. Do we think that's about Judaism particularly? It could be.
Or just his creation.
Yeah, I think that's more about the creation. Okay. Whereas in verse 17, you've got a very clear statement. What does that statement do? The law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. What is that verse saying? Yeah. First of all, it's setting up a contrast, isn't it? There is law and there is grace and truth. And like his other pairs of contrasts, there's no middle ground there. Now, he's going to go on, obviously, and we know this because we're the readers, we know that Jesus is better, although that verse doesn't actually say that, it just says that there's that contrast. And having dangled that in front of us, we're then going to see how through the rest of the gospel, John works that out and shows us that Jesus is superior. And he does that in lots of ways, but what I want to do tonight is just to look at five of them, if we have time. We're going to look at Jewish rituals, Jewish teaching, Jewish worship, Jewish festivals, and the Jewish leaders. And in each of those cases, John is going to try and demonstrate that Jesus is better than any of those things. And he's going to do it not necessarily just by coming out and saying so. He's going to do it through symbolism and he's going to do it through that interaction with different people. Okay? So that's our agenda for tonight. Let's have a look at Jewish rituals. Would someone please like to read for us 2:1-11? well-known story. Thank you, Sue. Okay, well-known story. On one level, it's a story about Jesus going to a wedding and kind of getting the best man out of the embarrassment of that situation. So it's a kind of Jesus is nice and caring story. But are there things in there which make us want to think that there might be a bit more to it than just that recounting of events? Remember that we said in John's Gospel there are no miracles, but there are seven signs. And we said that a miracle is just something that Jesus does to bless someone, heal them, whatever. But a sign is something which points. And this is the first sign. It's done to reveal Jesus' glory, John tells us. So what might this be pointing to? And where's that? There's a little clue hidden in there. You're on fire tonight, aren't you? Teacher's pet. Yeah, that's right. John specifically tells us that this water, I mean, it could have been anything, couldn't it? He could have got some out the river or just water that you had around, or presumably plastic bottled water if they had it in those days. But John specifically chooses to tell us what this water should have been used for. John doesn't put anything in by accident. We've said that before. And if that's there, that's there for a reason. Now, given what we've already discovered from the prologue, what is this story suddenly become about? The washing is basically, if you were a Jew, you have to do this ceremonial washing pretty much before you do anything, really. And without it, you're unclean. And so in order to be right with God, to be clean before God, you have to go through this ritual. Now, Jesus takes the water that you would use for that and turns it into a party. Yeah. And not just a party, there's another really significant verse, or couple of verses. Best till now. Jesus has come along with something new. It's better than what went before. And he's going to transform what went before into a party. Instead of keeping the law, this is about celebration and joy and abundance and all those things. I once worked out, I can't remember the figures now, but if there were six jars, why six, by the way? Again, on one level, that may be because there were six there, but why does John tell us there's six? Right, I hadn't thought of that. That isn't the answer I was after, but that's a real possibility that there's something about that. Now it's party time. You've done your work. Yeah. Now, yeah, that's amazing. I hadn't thought of that. No. There's an even... There's an even more. What's the perfect number?
Seven.
In Judaism. So therefore, six is...
Not quite perfect.
And at times, it's worse than that. At times, it's the number of evil. So in Revelation, 666 is like even worse than evil. It's just, So I think, again, John is saying here, this whole system is imperfect. But I do like the idea of you've done the work, now it's time to party. Okay, so you get the kind of idea, and suddenly this isn't just a story about a wedding, it's Jesus' manifesto. You're going through all this outward ceremony and everything. Now I've come, you're going to get the best, which has been saved till now. Get the idea? Okay. Let's move on then, and we'll do this more briefly because we talked about this last week, but Jewish teaching, and we won't read it, but just have a look at chapter 3. Who did we meet in chapter 3? And what did we say about Nicodemus last week, or last time? He came in the night, he came out of the darkness to meet with Jesus. Yeah, so he represents
the Jews
archetypally. Yeah. In fact, I'm doing some writing about him this week, so I might be conflating. But he is called a Pharisee in verse 1. He's a member of the Jewish ruling council. And in verse 10, he's a teacher. Now, it may be that you could be a Pharisee, a teacher, and a member of the ruling council, but actually that's a bit greedy. And so it may be that John is wanting to use him as a symbol of all things Jewish, or all authorities Jewish, and so he piles on the different titles to cover that the Pharisee is a political party within it. So that might be Jewish kind of ritual and stuff. The ruling council might be Jewish politics and the system, and then the teaching might be Jewish teaching, and he's going to expand on that soon. So Nicodemus is the archetypal Jew.
Okay.
What doesn't he do when Jesus starts talking to him? But before he disappears, he just doesn't get it. And we said, didn't we, last time, that, again, going back to the prologue, that Catalaban word about the light springing up in the darkness, and the darkness could neither understand it nor put it out. Master it, we said, didn't remember that? And Nicodemus is this lived out. He just doesn't get it. And he can only think on a literal level. So when Jesus talks about being born again, he immediately asks the question, how can I get back inside my mum's tummy again? You know, that's the only level that he can think of. And consistently, through John's gospel, we're going to see that the Jews just don't get it. The Jews as a religious system, religious group, just don't get it. Okay? We said all that last time, so that was just a recap. Now, this is the really interesting one. Number 3, Jesus and Jewish worship. And I want us to look at 3 passages, and we'll look at them all together, and then we'll try and tease out what's going on in those 3 passages, okay? So, first one, if someone could just read, please, 151... If someone else could then read a selection of odd verses from chapter 4, and then if someone else could read 2:13-22. Okay? Don't all fight over it. You might want to grab the one that's only got one verse. Thank you. Hold that thought. Okay, some odd verses from chapter 4. Brilliant. Thank you very much. Hold on to that lot. It's not making any sense, these scattered bits, but it will. And if someone could read 2:13-22, please. Okay. Well, what's all that about? All those different bits. Let's go back to 151 and 2 questions for you. The first question, there's a bit of a giveaway because I've put it on there, but what Old Testament story is that reminiscent of? Are we familiar with that? Jacob's ladder. Do you remember what a bit more what happened? Yeah?
There was a ladder.
In his dream.
In his dream.
Okay. People familiar with that story? Just a little bit? Okay. Clearly that's a reference to it there. Now, when it says this, you'll see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. What picture is in your mind there? And specifically, where is Jesus? in that picture. How do you see that? Okay, but just that picture of the angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man, if I asked you to draw that on a bit of paper, what would you draw? Where would you put Jesus? Okay, so Jesus is sat at the bottom, and there's angels coming and going between. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. That's the kind of picture we normally get, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it is possible in the Greek that Jesus is not Jesus is not sitting at the bottom. Jesus is the ladder. And where it says you'll see angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man, it could mean you'll see me on Saturday trimming my conifers on my ladder to get up there. And that the Greek construction could mean that Jesus is the ladder. Jesus is not the one being visited or communicated with by heaven. Jesus is the means of that communication, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, hold that thought. You can't prove that from the Greek, because it could very much mean Sarah's picture of Jesus at the bottom. But let's build up a cumulative picture. Where did that incident in the Old Testament take place? Remember? I'm trying to remember. Yeah. The point is that it was a holy place.
Mm.
I think that's the
Bethel,
yeah. Mm. And that was later to become a very significant place in Jewish history. So here is what the Celtic people today would call a thin place, where the gap between heaven and earth is very thin. And in fact, it doesn't take a very long ladder for this communication to happen. Right? So we are talking about a holy place, and Jesus might be saying, I'm the ladder. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the light of that, chapter 4, what's going on there? Where is it set? At Jacob's well. What do we know about Jacob's well? I think it was.
Right.
But again, what do we know from verse 6 and verse 12 about that place?
It's a holy place.
Great significance for them. And notice the dramatic irony in verse 12. Remember, we talked about that. People say things, and we as the readers know the answer to that question. Are you greater than our father Jacob? Now she means,
yes.
who can you possibly be?
Yeah.
But we know, absolutely I'm greater than Jacob. So Jesus meets this woman at a holy place with a significant history for the people.
Mm-hmm.
The discussion turns eventually, after they get off her sex life, to religion. Where should we worship? Because Jews say you've got to worship in Jerusalem. Samaritans say you've got to worship Mount Gerizim. And Jesus says in verse 12, 21, yeah. It's not about geography.
Mm-hmm.
Not about geography. It's about the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And the woman says in 25, well, when Messiah comes, he'll sort all that out for us. And Jesus says, it's me. If you want to know how to worship, you look at me. So twice now, Jesus has either alluded to or been in a sacred place, a holy place, and said in both cases, it's all about me.
Mm.
Now, in the light of that, chapter 2 and 19 onwards, what's going on there? And particularly 21. They're thinking about the temple, and Jesus says, forget the temple, it's all about me. And I think you've got those three incidents where Jesus either goes to or alludes to a place of worship, a sacred place, and in each case he says, it's me, I'm the ladder, I'm the communication portal between earth and heaven. It's not about your historic holy sites, it's about the Spirit who will be given to you. We've looked at that already, paradidomi, who will be given to you by me. And finally, and this is the clearest example at all, he was talking about his own body. And I think what John is wanting to say to us through this is that Jesus is replacing all their kind of institutes for worship, as it were, whether it's the temple or holy places or whatever, is all about Jesus' body. And therefore, when you add that to the inadequacy of the Jewish water and what have you, the fact that the Judaism just doesn't get it, Jesus said, look, here, it's me. For goodness sake, wake up to it. Get that? That's really clever, I think, that bit. And I think any one of those on its own, you could take it just as a story, but the accumulative evidence, and particularly verse 21 of chapter 2, doesn't leave anybody in any doubt at all that it is through Jesus that true worship. It was after the death of King Solomon that the nation divided into two, north and south, and the southern kingdom based around Jerusalem is what we call Israel today, and they're the lot that went into exile in Babylon and all that stuff. But the northern kingdom were overrun by Assyria and never really enter the story again. But it's thought that the Samaritans are the remnants of those. And I always think of the Samaritans as being like the Welsh. If you come from Australia or America or somewhere, you think of Wales as a subset of England. It's just a bit of England. But if you are English or Welsh, you know very well how that is certainly not the case. And there's a fierce rivalry. But from the outside, they wouldn't draw much distinction. And so the Samaritans were kind of half Jews. And I think you see it here, and you certainly see it in Acts, that when the gospel spreads out, there's a kind of ripple effect. And first of all, it's to the Jews, then to the Samaritans. So Jesus meets a Samaritan woman, and then to the Gentiles. And in John 5, Jesus heals a Gentile son. So you've got that rippling, and it's the same in Acts, you'll be my witness in Jerusalem, that's Lincoln, Judea, that's Lincolnshire, Samaria, that's somewhere foreign like Sheffield, and then the ends of the earth, you know. So you get that, I think you've got that going on as well. So yeah, they would kind of have the same sort of understanding, and she certainly expected the Messiah to come. But if you were a Jew, they'd be way beyond the pale, you know. Okay. Jewish festivals, and this is a fairly straightforward story. Someone like to read 7:37-39, please. Okay. A little bit of background will bring that alive to us. There's a passage in Ezekiel in the Old Testament about a river flowing out from the temple and getting deeper and deeper and kind of flooding everything as a sign of God's blessing and his fruitfulness sort of going out. And so the Jews used to have at the Feast of Tabernacles, which was a thing that, went on for about a week. But on the final day of that, verse 37, they would go to the temple and they would take loads and loads of water from the pool of Siloam, which was nearby, and they would take it into the temple, and then they'd kind of fling it down the steps and it would all flow out, and there'd be all this gushing water, and that was meant to sort of symbolize kind of almost enact Ezekiel's prophecy. And Jesus stands up on that occasion, and you can imagine the sort of temperature that it would be, and there's all this water flowing down, and Jesus stands up and says, "Is anyone thirsty?" Well, you would be, wouldn't you? Let's face it. But then he goes on, as he has in chapter 4 with the woman, to contrast this. And there would have been gallons and gallons of it, you know, it would have been a big show. But then Jesus talks about living water welling up from inside us. And John tells us that what he means is the Spirit. And I wonder whether we're supposed to see there a contrast between a man-made ceremony, we'll pour water down the steps to make it look like this, and the reality of the Spirit that Jesus brings. When we worked in, I won't say which diocese because this is going public, but I was planning a Pentecost festival in the cathedral. I was on part of a group that was planning that, and in particular we wanted to involve loads of children, and someone had the idea of getting, you know, you can get those little metallic shapes that I think you
like
stick
confetti,
them,
do you mean?
Yeah, kind of little metallic diamonds in all bright colors. Someone had the idea of dropping from the ceiling of the cathedral all these on the children's head and then getting some fans so they'd blow about and it would look like kind of flames coming down and so on. And I wanted to say, why don't we just pray for the children to be filled with the Spirit? You know, why do we have to create the human effect? Why can't we just do the real thing, sort of thing? And I think it's a bit like that there. You go through this ceremony to remind you of something and to enact what you hope might happen. I'm here. You know, let's just do this. You see what I mean? I think that's what that one is about. So Jewish rituals, Jewish teaching, Jewish worship, Jewish festivals, and the last one, the Jewish leaders. What has Jesus got to say about them? And I think there are two stories here. One is chapter 9. I think, again, we looked at that last time, didn't we, about the man born blind.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've also got in the next chapter the stuff about the Good Shepherd, one of Jesus' I Am sayings. What are we making of the Jewish leaders in chapter 9 and the story of the blind man? Is this merely the same point as Nicodemus, do you think, in chapter 3, not getting it? Or has anything progressed? Yeah, there's a hostility here, isn't there? And the leaders get more and more rude to this poor chap and end up in verse 34, you were steeped in sin at birth. I think that's a polite way of saying to him, you bastard, just tell us, dare you talk to us like that? And it's there's some quite vicious attack going on there. And then Jesus' comment, of course, is that actually the man who was blind has been made able to see. You lot are still blind. You can't see. Yeah. But there's much more hostility has crept into it there. And then Jesus goes straight on to the Good Shepherd passage, which we normally read as a standalone, but coming straight after that chapter 9, what do you think Jesus is saying in that passage? Exactly, you've got the contrast. He's shown us John has shown us some religious leaders in action when they get so wound up that they just lose it. And then, can you think of a parallel passage in the Synoptics? I think it's Matthew, which is saying the same sort of thing. What do the Pharisees do in Matthew particularly in terms of coming in? They're blind guides. It's 13 and 14. Hypocrites because... Yeah. I wonder whether that is John's retelling of that saying, but using the concrete picture. And you know that the shepherd would get the sheep in and then sleep in the doorway so that they couldn't get out, but neither could anyone get into them without waking him up, sort of thing. So there's clearly a contrast there, and he's actually saying in verses 11 and 12 is that contrast, isn't it? You're not committed to the flock, and actually you might be doing them harm. You're certainly going to save your own skin before, whereas I am going to go to the cross.
Yeah.
I'm going to lay down my life, literally. Mm-hmm. And that, anyone know what that chapter 10 is as an Old Testament passage that's kind of based on? Remember that? Okay. Ezekiel, yep, well done. Ezekiel 34.
Right.
We won't read it all, but the gist of Ezekiel 34 is this. Your shepherds... And again, Ezekiel is referring to the corrupt religious leaders several hundred years earlier. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. Woe to you, shepherds of Israel, who only take care of yourselves. Should you not take care of the flock? Da-da-da-da-da. You've ruled them. You've not strengthened the weak or healed those who are ill or bound up the injured. You've not brought back the strays. You've ruled them harshly. And so they were scattered, and my sheep wandered all over the mountains. And that, and every high hill is a reference to false worship with the different shrines and that. What's God going to do? Verse 11, I myself am going to come and be your shepherd. The human shepherds I set above you have lost the plot. I am coming to do it myself. And so when Jesus says, I am the good shepherd, we'll look at this a bit more next week, but he's saying a lot of stuff there, isn't he? And again, we're going to see next week, yes, it's set out in the prologue that Jesus is God, but the way that John is going to show us that is going to be in little ways like that. Again, that those echoes, the allusions to the past and that. And that's what's going on here in this chapter. Well, there we go. That's just some of the ways in which John handles that kind of difference between the Jewish rituals and what Jesus comes to bring. He does it obscurely, he does it on the slant, as it were, he does it through pictures, through symbols, through references and so on. But one more question to end with. We said last week that there's no middle ground. Do you see that again here? There's a lovely verse which again we would miss, which I think just puts the seal on that absolutely. Someone like to read 19:7, and this is Jesus just before he's going to be crucified, and this is Pilate arguing with the Jews about what's going to happen to Jesus. And verse 7 says, and that little phrase, we have a law, is the final and ultimate example of the Jews not getting it, not wanting it, not seeing it. And John, I think, puts that little phrase in to say that there is an absolute and final incompatibility. Yeah. We have a law, therefore Jesus has got to die. And again, there's that complete lack of middle ground. So that's what I think John is wanting to tell us about that. What's the take home from that for you? Are we does that speak to us because we're not Jewish and we haven't tried to keep the law? And so it's about the reality,
mm-hmm.
and not just about outward observance.
Yes. Which
Jesus
yes.
got lots to say about. Yeah. Is that a problem for Christians? There are two books in the New Testament which we haven't studied yet. We've done Obadiah, but we haven't done What are Galatians and Hebrews about, do you think, basically? Yeah. Both of those are about Christians being tempted to go back to Judaism, to go back to rule-keeping, to go back to law instead of grace and truth. And in their different ways, those two authors try and say, for goodness sake, don't get back to that. You've been rescued out of that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that was a problem just for the first couple of centuries. I think it's been a constant problem for Christians to add something. And one of the things Galatians is about is, I believe in Jesus, yes, he's my Lord and my Saviour, but it's Jesus plus circumcision as a Jew. It's Jesus plus my good works. It's Jesus plus. And Paul has some really, really, it's the letter of all Paul's letters where he gets the most angry. He really has a go at them. And it's not Jesus plus anything. It's Jesus. And our response, yes, we do want to live as better people and all that, but that's in response to the love of God, not to deserve or earn the love of God. Absolutely. Yeah. There are some people, and it's really hard to give them anything. And we learnt that, didn't we? With a bloke in our home church back in London. And I can't remember the story now, but we always just say, what would Bob do? Yeah, it's not a desperately good story, that, because we can't remember the details, but he was the most generous person you could ever hope to meet. I might edit this bit out, because I've lost the plot with it. But no, you're absolutely right. Some people find it really hard to receive and much easier to give. And I think one of the things we've tried to learn over the years is that there are times when we just need to receive. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. And I think as well, I was talking to someone recently, and again, I can't remember where it was, but about the difference between guilt and shame. I don't think we've talked about that in this group. Where was I? I don't know. But I think the more our society has lost a sense of sin, the more we have an epidemic of shame. And sin is when we... guilt is when we feel bad about something we've done. Shame is when we feel bad about who we are. And I was making the point that we're still preaching a gospel of sin. You must repent of your sins and come to Jesus. And people have no awareness of sin. But many people, particularly young people, are deeply ashamed of who they are. And I think our shame makes it hard for us to accept the grace and truth of Jesus, because we don't deserve it. And the whole point is, no, of course you don't. Otherwise it wouldn't be grace, you know? So I think there are many Christians who, without realising it, actually struggle with this and just want somehow to earn or deserve or or ritualize God. And John says to us, that's law, that's Moses, but grace and truth come through Jesus. So a moment of quiet and I'll pray for us.